are pleased to have with us for invited testimony in an informational meeting, Gene Thorne, Director of Department of Human Services, newly responsibled, shall we say. And Gene is going to give us an overview of the Department of Human Services. And more importantly, and this is the point of her presentation, the relationships of the services that OMAP provides to the other divisions in DHS. And I think when we're done, we will see that this is a very interconnected, very interwound, you know, service delivery network, and this is very involved stuff. So as we, you know, tweak, change, massage any parts of OMAP and the health plan, we impact other aspects all the way throughout DHS, and that does not just include or limited to mental health services and A&D services. I mean, this winds itself all the way through. So, anyway, with that, let me turn over to staff for Rick to give us a couple announcements.
Thank you, Chair. In your packets are two reports. One's Medicaid Cost Containment Report Number 1, and then there's Report Number 2. I just want to let you know these are just informational pieces for you only, that they're not part of Jean's presentation, so she shouldn't be queried about them because she's not had a chance to take a look at them. But these are two reports that come out of Washington State that the Lewin Group did an analysis of Washington State's Medicaid Cost Containment Initiative. Report number one basically is a table full of the various measures that they've enacted to try to contain Medicaid costs with dollars tied to them. Report number two is basically an analysis evaluation of that the Lewin Group did. And there'll be a report number three coming out that I'll pass on to you when it does arrive. So that's just for later reading.
And the name may look familiar because in Mr. King's presentation, he used some information from the Lewin Group. So, anyway, with those announcements, let me turn it over to the director, Gene Thorne.
Hey.
Thank you for being here.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Gene Thorne, Director of the Department of Human Services. Actually, I'm looking up at this and wondering what my stage name is and what my life's motto is and why. I'm wondering what that's doing in this room, but I assume you'll figure that out.
Fido, Rover.
I hope it's not part of this commission.
Is that distracting to you? We will have it removed.
I was enthralled with what you had to say, but I noticed that. Thank you for having me here today. I've only been able to tune in occasionally over the last couple of weeks to see the discussions this committee has had, but I think that the sense I have is you've been looking at the big picture, and it's very important to recognize the big picture that we are working within in providing health coverage in Oregon. And today, actually, before you start getting into the intricacies of the Oregon Health Plan and in Medicaid, I wanted to be able to at least set the stage for how Medicaid and the Oregon Health Plan are interconnected with other parts of the Department of Human Services and then outside the Department of Human Services. So as you look at the health plan further on in your deliberations, you have a better understanding of how there may be some pieces that you need to remember that the work that is done here may affect other parts of the department, other parts of state government, and other parts of the economy, in fact. Many think that the Oregon Health Plan is synonymous with Medicaid, and that's not true. The health plan actually has a number of components. Most of them people think of as the Medicaid piece of the Oregon Health Plan, but that was really an umbrella term that we came up with probably about 3 years after the legislation that first created what you think of as the Oregon Health Plan passed, and that's because we were tired of trying to explain what Senate Bill 27 was to the world. And the Oregon Health Plan really is a term that includes not only the Medicaid reform, but includes a number of activities that occurred in the late 80s, early 90s, including the creation of the Oregon Medical Insurance Pool, you know, the Family Health Insurance Assistance Program that you heard about. And so the term Oregon Health Plan goes beyond the Medicaid component. And Medicaid goes far beyond the Oregon Health Plan. It's the primary federal funding source for the Department of Human Services. It's used to support programs throughout DHS. And the health plan itself is interlinked with programs and other services that clients throughout the department receive. So what I'd like to do today is actually, first of all, start with a very brief DHS 101. I think probably at least Representative Cruz is for this. I'm not sure about the rest of you. But just to kind of get everyone on the same page about what it is that DHS does and is responsible for, but then spend more time looking at the impact on DHS's budget of Medicaid funding, both in terms of the general fund and federal fund components, how Medicaid supports programs throughout DHS, where the various Medicaid functions lie in DHS. And basically, it's you can't blame Lynn Reed for everything that may happen with the Oregon Health Plan or Medicaid.
Hold on. Are you getting this, Kelly? Is this sound coming back to the...
Oh.
Okay. Yeah.
I'll get it closer.
Yeah.
Okay.
And maybe angle it up a little bit.
Okay.
Sorry about that.
And
then pull... I have that same problem.
It's connected to our budget.
I will not make any comments here. I got it. I figured it out.
And maybe angle the other one towards you.
Okay.
Oh, no, that's your seat.
Okay. Okay, I think I've got it. I will not make any comments.
Is that any better?
Okay. Talk some about where the various, see, I can tell it's louder, and I'll speak more loudly, where various Medicaid functions are located in the Department of Human Services, how eligibility for entitlement programs interrelates with the Oregon Health Plan, because clients come in through many doors. In fact, most clients don't come in through a door that's labeled the Oregon Health Plan. They come in through other doors. Take a look at some of the caseload trends we've seen over the past years in Medicaid and Medicaid eligibles. And then lastly, also look at how the piece of the Oregon Health Plan in DHS interrelates with other parts in state government. So what I'd like to do, this is this first document, Oregon Department of Human Services, January 2003, is just an overview document that we've been using. I'm not going to go through all parts of this, but I just want to draw your attention to a few pieces. Page 6, which is our introducing DHS. The Department of Human Services really comprises a number of programs that serve primarily low-income Oregonians and other Oregonians who may be at risk. So it includes child protection, public health, welfare to work, voc rehab, mental health addiction services, services for seniors and people with physical and developmental disabilities. There are a certain number of services or certain services that are provided by DHS employees. Most of the work actually occurs out through contracts that we have either with county government or other providers. So when you look at the DHS budget, 80% of our budget goes out in payments. It's payments to counties, it's payments to providers, it's payments to individuals for TANF grants, et cetera. So 80% of our budget goes out in payments. About 16% of it is actually for the staff in the field and in our state institutions who provide direct services to clients. So it includes the field offices that actually are state-operated, includes staff at the Oregon State Hospital, the Eastern Oregon Psychiatric or Training Center, and some of our state-operated group homes. And then about 4% of our budget is really what would be the central administration. If you turn to page 12, let me spend a few minutes talking about the programs of the department, and then we'll get into how Medicaid fits with all of this. There are basically three what are called clusters that we have in the department now, program clusters. Actually, no one has figured out what to call them. They aren't divisions, but clusters is the best name we can come up with. Children, adults, and families is the first. Seniors and people with disabilities is the second. And then health services is the third. In children, adults, and families, we basically have the programs that were formerly, and it's the policy and state operations of the programs that were formerly in the Adult and Family Services Division and State Office for Services to Children and Families. So we have a number of self-sufficiency programs that work with low-income Oregonians, both in providing grants to them and assisting them in moving from welfare to work, including daycare and other supports that would be available to them. We have our child welfare programs also out of here, so dealing with alleged child abuse and neglect, foster care, adoption. So this is the part of the department that develops the policy and the program for self-sufficiency and child welfare. As we move into seniors and people with disabilities, this really deals with more of the long-term care part of the department, and when we spend a little more time on Medicaid, you'll see this is the other between health services and seniors and persons with disabilities. These are the two big chunks in the department that are the two chunks that reflect the Medicaid costs. And so in seniors and people with disabilities, we deal with long-term, a continuum of long-term care services. Formerly, Medicaid, you could only get Medicaid coverage for people who ended up in nursing homes. And Oregon really led the way back in the early 80s with first a pilot program, I believe it was down in Jackson County, and then subsequently led legislation at the national level that allows states to actually provide services in a person's own home or in substitute care who needs long-term care services. So we have a continuum of services to people who are elderly or persons with disabilities. The developmentally disabled, specifically, we have services related to these are, in many cases, people who formerly were served by the Fairview Training Center. And so we have state-operated group homes, community-based group homes, other support services to the developmentally disabled in Oregon. Health services comprises three main areas: the Office of Medical Assistance Program, public health, and mental health and addiction services. The Office of Medical Assistance Programs is the part of it that you'll probably spend most of your time on, and that is the part as we get into Medicaid more that actually administers the Oregon Health Plan, which also includes the Children's Health Insurance Program. The Medically Needy Program, which actually was eliminated as of February 1, and also assistance with Medicare premiums for low-income Medicare-eligible people. Public health includes the kind of population, most cases of population-based services, those services that may relate to clean drinking water, regulation of ambulance services in the hospitals, monitoring and prevention of communicable disease, vital records. There are certain more individualized services, public health lab services, family health services. Most of this is either administered at the state level or through county health departments. Mental health and addiction services includes the portion of the former Mental Health and Developmental Disability Services Division that was focused on mental health, and also the former Office of Alcohol and Drug Abuse Programs. So really looking at how do we, the program and policy around services around mental health and chemical dependency, whether it's outpatient, residential treatment, includes the operation of the Oregon State Hospital, other psychiatric facilities and residential facilities. And then prevention and treatment of problem gambling. So those are the major, actually, programs that the Department of Human Services administers. If you turn to page 27, now I want to start leading you, actually, why don't you turn to that, and I will get some other handouts to you. And now this is the 03-05 budget, but if you see here, you'll see that the total funds budget for 01-03, I believe, is somewhere around $9 billion. For 03-05 and the governor's balance budget, it's about $1.6 billion. Did I say $8.6 billion? Of that, about 25%, just about 26%, of the department's budget is general fund. Okay, so out of about an $8.6 billion budget, about 26% of the department's budget is general fund. Now, what I'd like to do is point you to the next set. Doesn't look too I don't have a cover page or anything on it. This is something we've pulled together in the last few days. But want to dissect the federal funds and the general funds and how they relate to Medicaid. And frankly, even though I've been in and out of the Department of Human Services over the last 25 years and spent 8 years as the state Medicaid director up until 1995, I was fairly surprised at how much Medicaid has become the department's primary funding source. And I think it speaks a lot to what we've done in terms of leveraging federal funds over the past several years. Now, these happen to be 01, 03, so we were looking at 03, 05, governor's balanced budget. But to give you a sense of the federal funds that the department has, almost 70% of them are Medicaid. So as you'll see, there are other sources of federal funds that come in, but almost 70% of them are Medicaid. The next page is the page that was interesting to me, because up until a week ago, I had been working off of old information, and I had understood that of the general fund budget, that 25% of the general fund budget, about 70% of it was for federal match. Actually, between federal match and maintenance of effort requirements, we're up to almost 87% of the department's budget. And so what you'll see of general fund budget, of the general fund that the agency in the legislative adopted budget for 01-03, 75% of it is used to match Medicaid. And I think what that really shows is that over the years, we have found more and more ways to take programs that had general fund, that were pure general fund, and leverage them. Now, there's an upside to that, which means we've been able to bring in federal funds and stretch our general funds further. The downside is that I think as you'll see as you get further into discussions around the Oregon Health Plan, that where in the past we may have had a fair amount of safety net in the community, for instance in mental health, with pure general fund, that as we, for instance, when the Oregon Health Plan came in originally in 1994 and we suddenly had 100,000 people who are now Medicaid eligible, we pulled that general fund out and said, okay, now we can use it to match. And so what we've done is we've pulled much of our general fund out of the safety net, and as we make reductions in our programs, not only are we losing the federal funds, but we may not have the safety net left. The next page is...
Mr. Chair? Excuse me.
Yeah.
Representative Cruz.
Thank you. Gene, are most... Well, I know food stamps isn't and Medicaid isn't, but are most of these other federal grants capped?
Mr. Chair and Representative Cruz, let's see. The Temporary Assistance to Needy Families is actually a block grant, and okay. So we have maintenance of effort. Food stamps, this is the administrative portion, so it's a 50-50 match, and as long as we can come up with 50%.
Right.
Foster care, I don't believe, is capped. Child care, I'm not sure about. I think that's a block grant, and this is a maintenance of effort. Voc rehab, I believe, is a matched program. It's a very small, as you can see, part of it. And the public health grants probably would be capped. So in most cases, it's a match, except where we perhaps there's a block grant, such as in TANF and child care.
Hold on. Gene, just a second.
Yeah, thank you, Chair. Gene, could you just describe maintenance of effort so we're all kind of on the same definition? When you say maintenance of effort, just define that briefly.
I've been on the job a month. But it is, for instance, and so this actually where this will be important is as the state starts looking at the president's new Medicaid proposal. So let's use a temporary assistance to needy families. When up until 1996, I believe it was, this was a matched program, basically our welfare programs, aid to families with dependent children. In, I believe it was 1996, this moved to a block grant program, which said there's a certain amount of federal money you can have and you can continue to have it. You don't have to match it. But whatever amount of state money you spent in a given time period, is you have to continue spending that amount of money in the future. And so part of, Ed, we've just kind of gotten the first little bits of information about the president's Medicaid proposal. And there would be, even though it would, you could opt to move more to a block grant approach, meaning there's certain amounts of federal funds you're going to get over the coming years, no more than that, no less than that. You don't have to match, but there's a certain level of funding that the state provided. And it actually, I think, in the president's proposal, increases that by a certain percentage each year. So you can't take the federal money, say, great, we're going to grab the general fund and go take it somewhere else. So there's basically some efforts that the state has to maintain. And so block grants are not meant to be something that allows the state, they're primarily something to allow the state more flexibility, but not to just use that as back, the federal funds as backfill for a state-funded program. As we move to the organization.
Excuse me, Gene.
Uh-huh.
Representative Bates.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Gene, I want to go back to you just for a second on the matched funds for Medicaid in and outside the Oregon Health Plan. With this shift of essentially a greater match than we've had before with more money, I would assume that, number one, that's been part of an economic driver of the state because that money goes in primarily to health plans and other similar things. But I'd be curious to know, because one of the criticisms we hear is that the Oregon Health Plan and others has just grown exponentially over the last few years, and my personal feeling is it hasn't grown any faster than any other health care program, private or public, but that possibly the amount of general fund money proportionally going that may have dropped actually for what you're buying over the last couple of biennials. If we're leveraging more and more money to do the same job that we did before, while we may be putting actually more general fund dollars in, it would seem to me that if you're leveraging that money, you're either serving a larger population or you're taking care of some of your medical inflation or you're just buying more. And I'd like to have an idea of what the general fund money going into the program has looked like, not just what the whole program looked
okay.
like. Okay?
You understand? And I can't answer that.
I'm not expecting that now, but we can look at that over the last couple of biennium. It might be interesting to see that while there's been a 15% growth across the board for health care, props to the general fund part of that hasn't grown because you kept leveraging more and more.
Mm-hmm. So has it grown proportional to the total? Okay.
Right.
Rick.
Thanks, Chair. And Gene, just to clarify, we've heard a lot, and you may be getting into this later, about the budget neutrality on Medicaid, and you said Medicaid wasn't capped. At some point, you're going to kind of differentiate how that works in terms of the amount of Medicaid dollars we can draw down based on neutrality. And you may have it later. But
actually, I don't, so let me do it right now.
Okay.
Medicaid, up until this point, for every dollar that is spent on a Medicaid-eligible service for a Medicaid-eligible client, if the state can come up with our 38 cents, in this case, I think our match rate's about 62.38, the federal government will put in its 62 cents. So it's all, and there's no cap. And so we can continue, as long as it's legal, if we can make people Medicaid eligible who weren't, maybe in the past hadn't been Medicaid eligible, or if we can take services that weren't Medicaid eligible in the past and make them Medicaid eligible, we can draw down those federal funds. And so at this point, there is no cap on it. My understanding of the president's proposal is that you would have an option, and is you could continue on this road, basically. Or you could go to a capped program that would front-load some money at in the first 3 to 8, actually, I think heavily on the first 3 years, somewhat less heavily on the next 5 years, and then it comes down after that. So there's a lot of assumptions in there. First of all, I probably will be retired in 8 years, so that would, so if you want to bet on the come, that we can live within that. But we are just starting to analyze the president's proposal, and there are a lot of things that are unknown because it says, for instance, the federal funds will grow at an as yet undetermined trend rate. Well, we have to make some assumptions about, and Luckily, we have someone working for us who worked at the Office of Management and Budget recently and knows something about this. But we will have to make some assumptions about what they might be talking about there. And to look at, as we look at, because we frankly, the flexibility they're talking about, we've pretty much gotten that flexibility through waivers. I mean, it would have been much easier to not do it through waivers. But we really need to look at whether and have discussions with you about, and first of all, this has to pass. This is not administrative. Congress will have to pass this. But whether or not it's the, it looks like we would get additional funding that would be worth the risk of what might be going long term. So we really need to look at this closely, and especially when you see that 75% of our general fund in DHS is tied up as match. This has huge ramifications throughout the department.
And Gene, you kind of spoke. My question was going to be, have you seen the detail of the proposal? And it appears that you have, and I was wondering if we could see that also.
Mr. Chair and Representative Cruz, I am sure that OMAP would love to give you whatever OMAP has received. And I think there was just a conference call yesterday of, and some talking points. But there's a lot that hasn't been defined.
I'm assuming that, but you know, as details come in, it'd be nice to get our hands on.
And we can get, in fact, we can get that to Rick so the whole committee can have that.
Thank you.
Hold on, Gene. Okay. I'll take Representative Anderson's question. Let's let then, Gene, get through some of this and write your questions down. They'll be just as valid.
I can do that.
20 minutes as they will be in 20 seconds.
I'll do it.
Gordon, go ahead.
I'll do it later.
If you turn to page 3, which is basically an organization chart of current organization chart of the Department of Human Services, and it shows that we've got Medicaid functions throughout the department, and it's not, so you think Oregon Health Plan equals OMAP, the Office of Medical Assistance Programs, and actually there's Medicaid throughout, and even the OHP part goes beyond that. There are three kind of major areas of functions in Medicaid. Eligibility. What's the policy around who's eligible? And then actually determining eligibility, determining that people fit within those categories. Secondly, there's the program and policy around what's reimbursable and for whom. So you've got eligibility, who's eligible, and determining that. And what are we going to pay for? How much are we going to pay for it? And then we have the administrative functions. We've got claims processing, auditing, financial reporting, caseload projections. So in many ways, at least the Office of Medical Assistance Programs is similar to a Regents or Blue Cross. We do claims processing. So you've got the eligibility, the program, and then the administrative functions. What I'd like to do is just touch on kind of some of the key pieces of this so you can see how Medicaid works in the department. And I'm going to start with health services, which is down in the lower left-hand corner. The person who serves as the administrator of the Office of Medical Assistance Programs is also designated as the state Medicaid director. Although, as you can see, these functions are throughout the department. And so there's a responsibility within health, and the Office of Medical Assistance Programs is within the health services cluster. There's a responsibility to provide coordination and oversight for the entire Medicaid program. OMAP, again, which is within health services, actually administers the part of Medicaid that relates to the acute or medical care needs as opposed to long-term care. So that includes the Oregon Health Plan, medically needy, assistance on paying for Medicare premiums. OMAP also processes all the claims for payment. So we have a very large, well, it's highly automated, but claims processing function. And so remembering that, and it's not just the pieces that relate to OMAP. Also, within the health cluster, we administer Medicaid mental health and chemical dependency services. In most cases, these are outpatient services, but there's also residential services. There's services provided in psychiatric hospitals. Although Medicaid, federal Medicaid law, does not allow Medicaid match on services in a state mental health institution, a large institution, for people between the ages of 21 and 65, they say that's a state function, they will provide it for those who are under 21 or over 65. Also, if there are residential settings where you have fewer than 16 residents, they'll allow Medicaid match there. So one of the things we are looking at as we are going through looking at the 0305 budget, our state hospital, most of those people there are 21 to 65. We have some that aren't. And that's a huge chunk of general fund. And so we're beginning to look at, and they're actually looking bed by bed at the state hospital. Is there a way, we can't do it quickly, but is there a way we could have more facilities that would be under 16 so that we could claim federal match for them? So this is, that's a big chunk of general fund that we said, but there are pieces of either residential facilities or for children and geropsychiatric patients where we can claim Medicaid match. We also, through the kind of public health arm of the department, have administered targeted. Back in, I think it was the late 80s or early 90s, the federal government allowed states to do what they called targeted case management services, where people meeting certain criteria and maybe even in a certain geographic area could have case management services and you could claim Medicaid match for them. We've used that term targeted case management in many ways to leverage more Medicaid funds. And so you have Healthy Start, Babies First. There are other programs that in this area, and you'll see it in some other parts of the department as well, where we've leveraged Medicaid funds. So health services is kind of the acute care part, claims processing, oversight, coordination of the program. To your right, you see seniors and people with disabilities. That's the other major part of the Medicaid program in the department. And in this arena, they administer the Medicaid long-term care services for people with who are elderly or persons with disabilities. That includes that full range of services I talked about. That includes nursing facilities, substitute care, in-home care, waivered services. They also determine or develop the Medicaid eligibility policy for people who are eligible because they are elderly or a person with disabilities. And I'll get to eligibility here in a moment. Because eligibility, there's manuals and manuals, but basically there are a number of ways you can become eligible. They deal with those pieces of eligibility that relate to programs that are primarily for persons who are elderly or with disabilities. They also administer services to the developmentally disabled, including ICFMR, which are intermediate care facilities for the mentally retarded, which is the term formerly Fairview Training Center, but smaller facilities now, group homes, community-based services, and also targeted case management here. So we have, wherever we can, we have leveraged federal funds to provide both residential and community-based services to the developmentally disabled. And then, actually, through seniors and people with disabilities, we have area agencies on aging. We have a fairly, I still haven't quite figured out all the intricacies of our field structure, but much of the field for the elderly and persons with disabilities, the actual field staff are not state employees, but it's county administered through the area agencies on aging. And so they determine Medicaid eligibility for persons who enter because they are elderly or a person with disabilities. Also, for OHP standard, and I don't think you've gotten into that yet, but if a person is 60 or over, they also do that through our field office, through primarily AAA Area Agency on Aging field offices. Now, if you look up on top, children, adults, and families. This, as I mentioned before, is a policy office. And they develop Medicaid eligibility policy for people who qualify because they are categorically eligible. And I'll get to some of this in a moment, which would include...
Hey, now, let me interrupt. What do you mean they develop policy those that are Medicaid eligible?
Okay.
Flesh that out.
Okay. As you'll see, I'll get in a moment. Actually... Would you mind if I wait in a moment?
Well, all right.
Okay, because I think when I get to the next pages, it'll...
You can write them down.
Yeah.
I lost my head.
You were going to let me continue.
That implies I had one to begin with. But
rules are all out then, right?
No. The chair has certain advantages.
Okay. I'd be happy to answer your question, but it might be better if I wait until the next page. Okay.
When it flows.
Okay, I will do that.
But
thank
don't
you.
Let me forget my question.
I won't. I'll get when we get to the next page. But also, again, in the child welfare arena, we have over the years used targeted case management and what's called personal care, which is a category of Medicaid-eligible services, to focus on we've leveraged federal Medicaid funding to support children in state custody. The community human services is really our field structure, and it's primarily the field structure for the former AFS and SCF. There are pieces of the former seniors in here, if it's state employees, and also vocational rehabilitation is in here. But basically, they determine Medicaid eligibility for children and families who come in because they qualify for one of these other programs I'm going to tell you about on the next page. Through our field offices, because if someone comes into a field office and is applying for temporary assistance to needy families, along with that, they're going through a process of being determined Medicaid eligible. And then also in the central office, we have a central processing branch that does Medicaid eligibility for those who are only eligible because of the health plan, pregnant women, and kids who aren't receiving a cash program. So a lot of this is not done face-to-face. It's done by a central branch. Beyond that, as you can see, there are other administrative functions and other parts of the department. Our IT, maintaining our Medicaid management information system, is in administrative services, federal financial reporting. In our finance and policy analysis, we have our budgeting functions, including caseload forecasting, rate setting, and then we have Medicaid audits are actually out of the director's office. So as you can see, we've got throughout the department the functions that have to work together to make a cohesive Medicaid system. Now, I'll get to the next page, which is to eligibility policy. There are actually, you've got two pages here, and there are actually many more categories than this. But we've tried to focus on what are the major categories by which someone becomes Medicaid eligible. Now, for each of these, such as temporary assistance to needy families, you'll see there's like a two-sentence description. The actual determination of eligibility, it goes into pages and pages and pages of manuals. It includes things like, how do you define what the family unit is? And so is it, if you've got a household where you've got a grandparent, a daughter, two kids, the father of one of the kids, or you have a grandparent and you may have, there are a number of different ways in which you define what a family unit is. I learned this when I was, not that I wanted to learn it in detail, but of how you define a family unit, what kinds of income is included or not included, what kinds of resource limitations. And so you'll see, for instance, on TANF, they can't have liquid resources, and by that be savings accounts or stocks or bonds, of more than $2,500. And so it's checking what do you have to look for. And so that's when I talk about policy. It's what is it that is required to be looked at and that clients need to be able to show in order to qualify. So we have, to give you a sense of just the December eligible, so you have an idea of how many were eligible. So they are also eligible for Medicaid by being eligible for TANF. About 64,000 people qualified for TANF and therefore also for Medicaid. That's individuals, so it's fewer in terms of households. Extended medical is actually for people who are going off TANF. And for a period of time, the federal government allows us to continue to provide Medicaid coverage for them because they either have had an increase in their child support or have earned income that now puts them over the limits for TANF. There are about 29,000 in December who qualified for Medicaid because they're in this group. For those who are in foster care, substitute care, they need to meet a whole variety of financial and non-financial requirements. We had 14,300. So for children who are in foster care and substitute care who meet these other requirements, they in turn qualify for Medicaid. The next one, Oregon Supplemental Income Program. I want to take a moment to talk about this because as you either delve into 0103 budget cuts, but this all continues in 0305, it's important for you to understand how the long-term care eligibility meshes with eligibility for the Oregon Health Plan. Someone could be eligible for Medicaid because they are blind, disabled, or elderly and receiving supplemental security income. That is a federal program. It's a federal cash grant, federal criteria for how one is classified as disabled. But income generally, again, there's pages and pages of detail, would be between, say, less than 75 or 85% of the federal poverty level. So you will have low-income people who qualify for SSI who get coverage from the Oregon Health Plan. The second bullet is more complicated, and that is a state can have an income limit for long-term care that is higher than a regular Medicaid limit. A state can go as high as 300% of the SSI level. So now we're up, since SSI is around 75 to 85%, we're up 200 and some percent of poverty. But they can't just be income eligible. They have to meet criteria that would make them eligible for long-term care. So when you hear about levels 1 through 17 in the long-term care system, and you hear about eliminating coverage for levels 15 through 17. Those levels relate to what kind of impairments a person has. And so 15 through 17, for instance, it may be someone who needs assistance, and I don't know all this stuff off the top of my head, but with some activity of daily living, maybe they need some assistance with dressing or bathing. But they don't, and but then as you work your way up to a one, those are people who require kind of 24-hour, very heavy medical needs. So we have someone who's at 200% of poverty, would normally not qualify for the Oregon Health Plan, but this is pre-February 1, they have some level of medical or social need that means they need some assistance to stay in their own home. That would qualify, they meet the criteria for level 17, for instance. Not only do they get that support service in their home, they get the Oregon Health Plan. They automatically qualify for the medical components. So the hospital, the physician, the prescription drugs, the dental care. As we say we are no longer covering levels 15 to 17, first of all, workers in the field are looking to see, are they still classified as a 15 through 17? Because if it's been a while since we've done the assessment, maybe they're really a level 12 now. But assuming they still are a level 15 to 17, then they also have to look at what is their income and would they qualify under the first bullet here. So if their income, if they're in a level 15 through 17, and their income is somewhere between, let's say, 85% of poverty and 222% of poverty, they not only lose their long-term care, they lose their eligibility for the health plan. If their income is below that, they lose long-term care, but they still have their eligibility for the health plan. So as you deal with this, this is a very complicated piece, and we've been back and forth with the feds on what we can do on the senior side. We actually looked at dropping from 300% down to 100%, but then there's all sorts of things about trust that people can keep and implications for that on the mental health side, and it was going to cost us more in other parts of the department than we would save here. But this is an important thing to remember as you deal with the health plan, as you deal with the budget, as we move into 03-05. In December, in this category, both bullets, we had 85,900 people who qualified for Medicaid for the Oregon Health Plan because they met these criteria. The General Assistance Program, which has been a general fund only program, that was eliminated as of February 1. However, if someone looks like they could be eligible for, it's a little more than that, but goes through a process where the state is required to determine whether someone might be presumptively eligible for the federal SSI program. And if it looks like they are, then we must continue, or we must provide medical benefits to them, even though the federal government has not made a determination yet. So the people who are in the general assistance program, although they may have lost their cash grants, they will continue in the Oregon Health Plan. And people in the future who look like them would also receive the Oregon Health Plan benefits. So, but in the future, it wouldn't be referred to as general assistance. It would be that they are presumptively eligible. They are presumed to be eligible to meet the disability criteria, income criteria. So we had about 2,500 people in that program as of December. The next category is a category that really has grown over the years as the federal government has allowed states to do more and more. Back when I started in Medicaid in 1987, basically, when you got to this, actually above general assistance, once you got to this, there was no more Medicaid. If you qualified for cash grant, you'd get the medical. But Congress in the late 80s really started opening up Medicaid coverage to other lower-income people who were above income limits that would qualify them for, in essence, welfare programs to provide more coverage specifically focused around low-income pregnant women and kids. So in what is called, we never did come up with a great name back and whenever we started this program in the late 80s, the Poverty Level Medical Program, and now also the Children's Health Insurance Program. We are mandated to cover, and frankly, all the ones on the top are mandates, except, you know, we have on the income level for OSIP, we could decide to go something lower than 300%. We are mandated to cover children under age 19 to the federal poverty level, and we are mandated to cover children under age 6 and pregnant women up to 133% of poverty. We, as a state, have chosen to go to 185% of poverty, though, for children under age 19 and pregnant women. As of December, we had pregnant women in this group. So these are people who don't otherwise qualify for a cash grant. We had about 7,600 pregnant women in the program and 106,700 kids. So this is a huge, as I said, in 1987, we didn't have the ability to cover kids who weren't on cash grants. So now we have 106,000 children up to age 19 to 185% of poverty. We are covering that 15 years ago. We didn't even have the ability to cover them under Medicaid. The last category on this page, then, are those who have come in because of the waivers we had received back in 1993 and began in 1994. And these are people who aren't there's no category in federal law that would normally allow them to become eligible for Medicaid. But because of our waivers, we were able to cover other people under the federal poverty level with Medicaid coverage. And these are all adults because kids are covered over in the other programs up to 185. And as you can see, they have to have income under 100%, resources of less than $2,000. When we began the program, there was no resource test. We went to $5,000 resource test, I think, in 95, and then $2,000 later than that. They have to meet residency and citizenship requirements. And with our new waivers, new people coming into the program will have to be uninsured for 6 months prior to enrollment. So there's an uninsurance requirement that's part of it. Those are the major categories. The next page are more specialized categories. Column, citizen, alien, waived, emergency, medical. Most of this is for delivery costs for women who otherwise don't meet citizenship status. And there's a, I hate to even go down this road because I don't know all the details. It's not an issue. For someone to qualify for regular Medicaid, they would be a resident, when I say a legal resident from another country, but they have to have been in the United States for a certain period of time, worked a certain number of hours. And so you have people who are legal residents here, but don't meet that. And so we have most of the cost here is for emergency services. Most of them are for labor and delivery. In December, we had 18,700 people, so it's just for that specialized service. Breast and cervical cancer medical, this is another program the federal government allowed us
hold
to...
Hold on a second.
Well, she gets to ask questions?
Yeah. Let's put it this way. Everyone in the committee gets to ask questions, with the exception of... I didn't say anything. Representative Morgan.
Well, I almost forgot my question. Do in the citizen alien waived emergency medical category, do people stay on that for very long, or is that kind of an in-and-out thing?
That's it, Mr. Chair and Representative Morgan. That would be in-and-out. It's for a specific service that would be constitute an emergency service. And so, in fact, as we've been doing audits and we've been dealing with hospitals that may have been doing more than they should have, and we've been collecting from.
So the 18,700 people that were involved in this in December, is that high, low, medium? What's the range?
Okay, so that may go up in the summer, come down in the winter. So, but these are basically episodic emergency episodes. So it's not someone staying on a caseload.
Mr. Chair, a related question?
Related question.
I'm not Medi-Cal, I'm not really that familiar with, but is this a separate pot of money from all other Medicaid funding so that this isn't, I mean, do we match this the same as we do Medicaid, or is...
Yes, it is. Mr. Chair and Representative Cruz, yes. And this would be all states have this.
This is required.
This is required.
So whoever, basically anybody who meets these federal requirements and presents, we do.
Yes, and you have to, I mean, it has to be classified as an emergency. And, again, it's much more detailed than this.
Okay, and it's a federal definition of emergency?
Lynn Reed knows these things, so...
Lim Reed, the acting administrator for OMAP within the Department of Human Services. There is federal law that defines emergency related to the CAWM program. It is a little, it allows you to be a little more stringent than we can in the regular Medicaid program, and we are more stringent. It doesn't have the prudent layperson language in it. So we do look very closely at whether or not something qualifies as an emergency, sudden onset, severe symptoms that must be treated immediately, plus delivery.
Yeah.
But the next question then is if they present with or without the CAWM funds, is a federally funded nonprofit hospital going to treat them under any circumstances?
Yes.
Well, I mean, Mr. Chair, I imagine, you know, if a hospital has someone come in an emergency situation, they would treat them and then look to see if there's some kind of coverage after the fact. So they have certain responsibilities to treat. And see, Dr. Bates is, Representative Bates is ready to jump
so
in.
So we are...
We're providing reimbursement to hospitals and some clinics
and
for services.
And mitigating the shift.
Mm-hmm. There we go.
Fair enough.
Okay.
Is that right?
You know, Chair, I mean, I'm holding my questions over here, but on this one. I've got five or six for you. You're lucky I have to leave for another meeting, but I'll be back.
Be back.
I knew that, Gene. That's why.
There is no way a hospital is going to have an emergency come into their emergency room or a woman ready to deliver who will be delivering a U.S. citizen, I'll note for you, and say no. And so what you're really talking about here is cost shift.
That's
if we don't pay for it and we go back and ask the hospitals for the money back, it is cost shift. Mm-hmm. The services rendered, the cost is there. We're cost shifting.
Mm-hmm. So two-thirds of the payment to the hospital at least can be picked up by the feds, even though it doesn't cover mm-hmm. all the costs.
That's correct.
Round numbers. Mm-hmm. Okay, Gordon's been down
now,
the road.
Following up on this question, I've got some others, too.
You get one right here.
Did you say that in Cowem it was mostly women?
Yes,
I heard you
primarily
say.
75 to 80% of the costs are labor and delivery costs.
And pregnant women?
We do not cover prenatal care.
In Cowem?
That's okay. Correct.
All right, go ahead. One more.
I think only pregnant women deliver.
Well, this goes way back to the beginning. So.
Okay.
Okay. Breast and cervical cancer medical, a new program the federal government allows. We have had 64 women in that. So very small program. I think it's just been in the last year or two. Qualified Medicare beneficiaries. And now, everything on this page is not in the health plan. These are Medicaid non-health plan costs. Qualified Medicare beneficiaries and specified low-income Medicare beneficiaries. The federal government over the past several years has first was option and now required that states for low-income Medicare beneficiaries that we pay their Part B premiums. So each month a person has a certain amount of money they have to pay for Part B Medicare coverage, which is basically your physician coverage, and Part A is hospital, Part B is physician and some ancillary services, and co-pays and deductibles. So what's happened over the years is that state Medicaid programs, as Medicare premiums, co-pays, deductibles have increased, state Medicaid programs are required to pick up those costs for low-income beneficiaries. Lastly, we have the Medically Needy Program. This program was eliminated February 1st. It was a program that was much broader than this back in the 80s and early 90s. What this means is, and at this point, the program had only focused on those who were elderly or a person with disabilities and only covered prescription drugs and mental health treatment. This is a program where someone can have income however high. I mean, there's no top income limit. But if they incur medical bills that then would bring their income down to the level of what would be the regular Medicaid program for elderly and disabled, which is about 56% of poverty, then we would pick up their prescription drug and mental health costs for the remainder of the month. So there's no upper income level, but this is for people who they could be a little over and have just a little bit of cost, or they could be a lot over in terms of income and have a lot of costs. So we have, as you'll see in that subsequent chart, we've seen a lot of growth in this program, although it had been fairly static for a number of years. So as of December, we had 8,200 people in that program. 8,200 people in that program. The next page, I think, gives some sense of what we've been seeing in terms of caseload trends.
Dean, we know the medically needy is not a federal mandate.
It's an option, yes.
And how about the breast and cervical cancer?
That's an option as well.
Okay.
And we would not have to cover pregnant women and kids over 133.
What about the qualified Medicaid?
Most of that is mandated. I think there was a piece of it that was... It's all required
okay,
now.
So everything on these two pages is mandated except the breast, cervical cancer, and the medically needy.
That's right. And then what we've done with the new eligibles in the Oregon Health Plan.
I'm confused. There is a Medicaid mandate, but that's reconstruction, right?
That's
a whole different. This is screening?
This is full benefits, but if they meet, benefits? There's only 64 women in this. This is a new program.
I know there's a mandated Medicaid program for reconstruction, I believe, isn't there?
No, I don't think so.
Okay, before we move off of these two pages, let's clear up the questions off of these two pages. Representative Anderson.
Could you go over and just give us the numbers on each of these areas,
okay.
$64,000 for TANF and et cetera?
Okay, I'll just run down those numbers quickly.
Further
TANF
up.
Was $64,000. Extended medical, $29,000. Foster care, $14,300. OSIP, $85,900.
I'm sorry,
$85,900. General assistance, $2,500. The next category, the PLM and CHIP, pregnant women were 7,600. The kids were 106,700 for a total of 114,300 in that.
What's the kids again?
106,700. The health plan new eligibles were 91,200. 91,200. COWM, 18,700. Breast and cervical cancer medical, 64.
64
people. Okay. Women. Well, not especially women. Qualified Medicare beneficiary, 15,600. Medically needy, 8,200. When you go to the next page, and
any
I...
Any other questions on these?
Okay.
Representative Murphy.
No.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Wanted to going back to the Oregon Supplemental Income Program,
mm-hmm.
and specifically the second bullet on long-term care,
mm-hmm.
I wanted to understand on those two items, the levels 15 through 17, were those eliminated during the e-board process?
No, those were part of our House Bill 5100 cut.
That's part of 5100.
Yeah. And then we're scheduled to eliminate levels 10 through 14 as of April 1.
And that decision was made through?
House Bill 5100.
Also. So both of them were in there.
Yes. And you'll have... What you'll see on our spreadsheets, if you've looked at our cuts matrices, is that although you'll see X number of people losing long-term care coverage, you'll see a companion piece on OMAP that shows some lesser number losing the health plan coverage because some people flip down to another category of coverage.
I see. And follow on to that, Mr. Chair. The impact on the homes that I think we've all been hearing about, the potential
mm-hmm.
Bankruptcies, if you will, of care facilities, is that an issue that your department is
yes.
immersed in?
And Mr. Chair and Representative Merkley, that is more a reimbursement issue because, for instance, in the levels 15 through 17, of course, I don't have all my notes with me on this, but I believe... there are around 4,000 or 4,500 in that category. All but, I believe, somewhere around 300 have in-home services. So almost all those people have in-home services. There are a small number of nursing homes, and then maybe a couple of hundred, I think, who are maybe in adult foster care, assisted living. As you move down to levels 10 through 14, that's another 4,000, 4,500. Again, most of them, something like 3,000 of them are receiving in-home services. So you still have the preponderance of the people who would be losing coverage, who would be receiving services in their home. The issue around whether or not we will have nursing facilities, assisted living facilities, others closing their doors, is a provider reimbursement issue because as part of the 5100 cuts, I think it's been at, some of it may be December revenue forecast. I think there was a piece in the December revenue forecast and the rest in 5100. We're reducing rates to most of those facilities. And so for those facilities that have heavy Medicaid, I mean, you may have 80% of patients in some facilities that are Medicaid. That's a significant impact on them. There may be other facilities that have a small proportion of Medicaid, and they may be in a better position to absorb. So that really is not so much an eligibility issue as it is a reimbursement reduction issue.
Okay. Thank you. I have one more question, slipping in here. Okay. Switching to the medically needy,
mm-hmm.
That was a House Bill 5100 decision also?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Okay.
Representative Morgan.
I'm making the assumption, and if it's not correct, please correct me, that there are people that qualify for more than one of these categories.
That is correct, Mr. Chair and Representative Morgan, to some degree. You may have, probably the main thing is that if someone is elderly or disabled, not only do we pay for their services, but if they are also Medicare eligible, we pay for their Part B premiums. So we have a number, in fact, probably, well, at least the majority of people who are in what's called the OSIP program who also qualify for Medicare. We call them dual eligibles. So we pay their Part B premiums, we pay their copays and deductibles, and then we also, for services that aren't covered by Medicare, predominantly prescription drugs, we pick up those costs under Medicaid. So that would be, I think that would be the main area where you would have someone kind of, they're classified as one or the other. They're not classified in two programs, but we have a number of dual eligibles.
So if you could, what I'm trying to get to is how many individuals are covered by all these programs rather than the count in each program?
400 and some thousand is what we have. And so actually, if we move, if you want to move to the next page.
We've got a couple questions. Representative Phil.
Thank you. I think when you gave us these figures, that's the average monthly caseload. Is that correct?
That was Mr. Chair and Representative Tomei, that was the December caseload.
December caseload.
It was
thank
December
you.
02 caseload.
Thank you.
On.
One quick. Never mind.
Oh. Thank you, Chair. the qualified Medicare beneficiaries and specify, I guess we call them the Quimbys and Slimbys.
Mm-hmm.
Isn't there a payment to the Medicare as part of that? What benefits do they get from?
We pay, Mr. Chair and Rick, we make the premium payment, which is probably 50 some dollars a month. And what that means is then when they go into the physician's office, Medicare picks up the physician's cost, although we would pick up the copay. So Medicare is the primary on that, and we are the secondary. But we pay for Medicare to be the primary on that. Okay. Page 6, now there's a – I probably should have had someone bold down at the bottom because your 0103 and your 0305 numbers do not account for any of the latest cuts, including November Emergency Board, December Revenue Forecast, or House Bill 5100 cuts, or the governor's balanced budget, which continues all of those. But I wanted to basically have you look back and see kind of how some of these caseloads have grown over the last few biennia to get some sense of the degree to which our caseloads may relate to aging of the population, economic conditions. So what you'll see is in TANF, now I found out this isn't just an issue of the economy, but if you look at the 9901, the average monthly caseload versus 0103, part of that does relate to the economy. In our welfare caseloads, it started to go back up. But part of that also relates to perhaps some coding that staff weren't doing quite correctly because I mentioned extended medical. So if someone moves off temporary assistance to needy families, they're actually in another mandated category, but sometimes it's just easier for field staff to classify them over as an OHP family because the benefits were all the same. And so actually, and you'll see as we get down further, so there were people who were classified one place who should have been classified under TANF. Who are receiving extended medical primarily. But part of that is also the recession. So you can see, again, this is a mandated group. So we had an increase there. When you see ABAD, that's aid to the blind, aid to the disabled, you'll see a steady growth there in terms of the number of people who qualify, low-income people who qualify because of their disability. Again, a mandated group. The elderly, again, you know, a mandated group, you'll see a growth there. So from 27,000 up to 31,000. Foster children, some growth there as well, and that's probably more just growth in the population. The poverty level medical women and children, you'll see, I think, basically probably the growth in the population, some impact from the recession as well. So these are pregnant women and kids who are up to some level of above poverty. The Children's Health Insurance Program is a program that Congress passed in the late 90s that allowed us to provide with an enhanced match, a 70-30 match, coverage to uninsured children. So we currently cover to 185% of poverty. So you'll see that was a specific policy decision by the state with the legislature to enter into that program and begin covering lower income children who are not had not been eligible before. So as you can see, because it began in 97-99, the average caseload then was about 5,000 up to about 20,000 in the current biennium. The next two categories are those that are eligible because of our health plan waivers. So this is the all those other ones are ones that when I say people come in through other doors, these are the other doors they come in through. But it's really these groups, these two groups, that constitute what we would now call calling OHP standard. Of those who are under the federal poverty level, about a third of them are parents. So their kids may be covered over in the poverty level medical or the CHIP program, but parents only have coverage because they're not on welfare, for instance. They don't meet some of the other categories, but they receive coverage. So the parents of the kids receive coverage under OHP, what's now going to be now called OHP standard. Then we have what we call adults and couples. That's the other two-thirds of the OHP eligibles. These are people who may be single. They may have kids, but their kids are 19 now, so they're no longer dependent children. Or they may be couples with that. They may be single or they may be couples. So two-thirds of the people we cover in OHP only fit this criteria, so they don't have dependent children. So that's the group that's just, and I think probably as you get further into your discussions, this is the group most at risk because we only cover them because of the waivers. Qualified Medicare beneficiaries, you can see, has stayed fairly steady. Medically needy, I was really surprised coming back to the department after having been off doing education for the last few years. Medically needy had always been pretty steady, around 3,500 or so. But you can see how it's grown over the last couple of biennia. I don't believe we've done any research into this, but anecdotally, what staff are saying is as prescription drug costs have gone up, people have found out about this program and have turned to this program to help them with their prescription drug costs. So, again, we saw a fairly significant increase in that program.
Representative Morgan.
Just looking at these, there seems to be a couple of areas where the growth has really been big, and one of them's TANF, and the other one's the OHP adults and couples. Mm-hmm. Can you talk to us about why there was such huge growth in those areas?
Yes, Mr. Chair and Representative Morgan. I think on TANF, although I believe our caseloads did go up some, I think what you'll see is the OHP family's parents has stayed fairly steady. I think this is where the feds came down and said, you're not putting people in the right category. You shouldn't be putting them in OHP family's parents. They look more like TANF, so perhaps they're on extended medical. So that's part of the, I think we've just had a shift in some cases from the one category to the other. But then I think the adults, couples, we are talking very low-income people. You'll get more information as you get further into the health plan. When you look at the income of the income levels of these two groups are very different. And so when you look at OHP standard, the 100,000 or so who are in only because of our waivers, on the families the parents. You'll see they're kind of spread 0% up to 100% of poverty. The adult couples are concentrated down near the bottom. And we look at the last 3 months of income. And so I think probably here you'll see, because of the recession, more people who are without income completely or very low income tend to be in this group. This is a group, and this is why when we look at the utilization of chemical dependency services among the whole Medicaid population, there's a concentration here. After the November Emergency Board made the decision to eliminate mental health, outpatient mental health, and chemical dependency services, I know the Judiciary Committee, I happen to be there, heard a lot from law enforcement and community corrections about how they've really used this program with parolees to try to get them treatment. So I think this is probably likely recessionary caused in here, because we've had, as the recession, I mean, we've just had more people coming in our doors for services.
So to clarify then, all of the people that were receiving the chemical dependency, the drug counseling, and the alcohol counseling were in this category?
Not, Mr. Chair and Representative Morgan, no, not all of them. But I know that chemical dependency providers have said, I mean, when you look at, 67,000 out of 400,000 people, that's, I don't have my calculator, but I know chemical dependency providers have said, out of all of the Medicaid group, by taking chemical dependency eligibility away from this group, they may be losing 60 to 70% of their Medicaid revenues. So there's less utilization of those services in the other groups, big utilization in this group. So as you delve further into who constitutes this group of standard clients, I think you'll see some very differences in their utilization of services, and you also need to break that group out into, is it parents of kids, because their utilization looks more like TANF and others, versus those who are adults and couples. And you'll see some differences in terms of gender and age distribution as well.
There was also, I think, and this gets back to your maintenance of effort comments, I think in 99-01 we were pushing the envelope as to the definition or lack thereof of maintenance of effort, and I think it's one of the reasons we had to include. So is this correct, Lynn?
I'm sorry.
In 99-01 we were pushing kind of the envelope on maintenance of effort and trying to shift some of these clients into other categories so we wouldn't be required to have the maintenance of effort dollars. Trying to still make sure they had services. Then the feds were knocking on our door.
We don't have maintenance of effort. Maybe that was okay.
Right, and so they had to come back into TANF, and that's one of the reasons I think it's...
There may have been something outside Medicaid, because currently there is no maintenance of effort requirement on Medicaid.
But on TANF there is.
Yes, there is.
Mr. Chair.
Representative.
Yeah, Gene, would there be any evidence? I mean, I'm looking at the growth in the medically needy and assuming that a huge portion of those folks are there for mental health drugs.
Mm-hmm.
Is there any correlation? I mean, would this be a catchment for folks falling through the cracks mm-hmm. of our mental health system? So this is mm-hmm. kind of the final place where those folks are ending up?
Mr. Chair and Representative Cruz, I believe somewhere around half of the drug I heard this yesterday, about half the drug expenditures for this group are for mental health drugs, I believe. Okay. I think there may be people who have income that's higher than 100% of poverty. Mental health drugs are a huge expenditure throughout the entire program, but I believe for medically needy on the drug, we just covered drugs and mental health treatment, and I believe somewhere around half of the drug costs are for mental health drugs.
Okay, but I guess, I mean, you know, we've got a very disjointed delivery system for mental health now, and I'm wondering if this is where a lot of the growth is, because that's the only place some of those folks have to end up.
We have, Mr. Chair and Representative Cruz, I think we have also in the OHP standard, especially the adults couples, heavy utilization of mental health services in there as well. And again, we had, to kind of go back pre-OHP, folks who fit in here, these two categories, didn't qualify for Medicaid coverage. We had general fund out in the counties to serve the most severely mentally ill, but it was pure general fund. When we expanded Medicaid eligibility to cover this, a lot of those people had been receiving those services. We pulled general fund out, put it over in the health plan budget because now we could capture federal funds with it. But that means we have less available as a safety net in the community.
Yeah.
Okay. Representative Mark.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Gene, would that category also be where the anti-rejection drugs, because they're very spendy, and also AIDS mental health, I mean AIDS HIV?
Mr. Chair and Representative March, it depends, because we have, if a person is low income enough and they otherwise qualify, because we have people throughout here where we're paying for HIV, AIDS, anti-rejection medications, but medically needy would be for those who are higher income who would not normally qualify, and it, they may have the spendy medications that would bring it down to that.
Thank you.
I have one more page.
Very glad you're back, Representative Bates.
One more page. I'll be back for the last page.
I'm glad you missed me. Yeah, next time.
This has been recording your thoughts.
Make sure your beeper.
And it's blank.
Well, that's an improvement from yesterday.
The last thing I wanted to point you to is the page 7, the circles chart. And this again.
Representative Anderson, you have a question on this page?
No, let me ask you. This came from something you said early on. Got me thinking. The federal government picks up 62 cents out of each dollar, and yet we, the providers, are paid less in this state than they are in most other states. Isn't that correct?
Mr. Chair and Representative Anderson, I don't know that that's correct. The problem is you have to come up with a general fund. And so we could increase reimbursement and get federal funds, but we have to come up with a general fund to do that. You may be thinking on Medicare, because on Medicare, on Medicare HMOs, for instance, which is, and this is all federally funded, it's where states have had higher utilization in the past, such as Florida, and maybe they haven't controlled costs. Federal government gives them a lot more per person per month than in a state like Oregon. So that may be what you're thinking of.
Representative Dr. Anderson is actually correct. It's the Medicaid program he is talking about. And the difficulty is that states can raise reimbursement rates to physicians and dentists and anyone else up to the usual and customary fees if they chose to, or if they could. Probably is a better statement, they'd like to. Even with that rich match we get, raising enough general fund money to bring the match down at a level that would pay physicians and other providers their usual and customary costs would probably raise the cost of the program, I would guess, by about 30 or 40%. And so it's not, one of the things I talk about is we have no or very little control over the Medicare program at the state level and what reimbursement rates we have there, which are very low compared to the states. We have no control over the Medicaid programs we have. We could raise those compensation levels up if we chose to put more general fund dollars in and bring it down. Most other states do about what we do in the Medicaid program for the same reason. They can't raise enough general fund money to bring those rates up. And we do the same thing to hospitals as we do to physicians and others. So Medicaid patients have a real problem with access, and of course there's a huge cost shift because that service is still supplied. It can't be shifted to Medicare, so it's shifted into the private pay, and you end up having extremely high premiums for multiple reasons, but that's part of the reason. We have high premiums to pay for people in the commercial market.
Thank you.
Is that a motion, Representative Bates? As a motion, I move that we start bringing in some general fund money out of that new oil field that we just discovered in Lane County.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. How do our numbers compare per capita to other states? Everyone has touted the Oregon Health Plan, have looked to us, we cover more, or they say, in perception anyway, there are more people in Oregon that receive more services and get better care. Well, what how do we compare?
Mr. Chair and Representative Monis Anderson, I'm going to take a stab at this, and then maybe when you bring Lynn. Oh, Lynn, look at this. There she is right there. I think our problem, oh, you did get, I had heard that as of the other day, we had the most recent state-by-state we had was 97-98. Lynn, do you want to explain this since I haven't seen this chart before?
Lynn Reed. Oregon is, in terms of the amount of expenditures, this is based on 2000, for our Medicaid program, this is spending per resident, so it would give you an idea of how much of our tax dollars we're spending. We rank 34th in the nation, and we're spending on an annual basis per resident $496 for our Medicaid program. The U.S. average is $596. And maybe as a comparison, California is just a little above us at $502. Washington is below us at $411. Now, the amount we spend per Medicaid client compared to other states, we rank 44th. We spend less. That can be the result of lower reimbursement. It can be more managed care, better management of services, lower utilization, more cost-effective. A number of issues can come into play. And we rank 44th, and the annual spending per Medicaid client is $3,032, whereas the U.S. average is $3,799. And California is 51st at $2,116. Washington is 48th at $2,653.
So we're in the middle of the pack, or follow-up.
Well, we're not. I mean, we're in the middle of the pack for Western states.
Right.
For Western states.
But we're down
states.
Towards the bottom, which, you know, that can be read as good or bad. Mm-hmm. I think that in Oregon, we may have, especially on the long-term care side, through the use of our waivers, may have extended coverage to persons, to more people that might have not been eligible in other states. But when we extend it to them, then it's also at a lower cost. As we extend coverage to the health plan standard population, we have more people in. Generally, they may, depending on which of the groups they may be in, they may be at somewhat lower cost than obviously the elderly and disabled are. So we have, you know, I think in the past, we have always, even prior to the health plan, we've had a fairly, well, we were one of the first states with managed care in our health. I mean, this is back in the mid-'80s. And I think we felt we did a good job of managing care and managing costs, but also, you know, you get into provider reimbursement, it's very difficult to compare one state to another. We have some, for instance, even in hospitals, because we have differential hospitals. If you're a type A or type B, we pay 100% of cost, which is higher than Medicare pays. If you're a DRG hospital, we pay considerably less than that.
And when we come in to present some of this information later in your deliberations, we're also going to have some comparisons for you at that time, comparing Oregon to other reform states so that you can get some sense of what's going on in other states.
Mr. Chair.
Hold on. Representative Cruz.
Yeah. How about a comparison of percent of population on Medicare? How do we compare with other states
on Medicare
there?
Medicare or Medicaid?
Medicaid, excuse me.
I'll see if we can get that in.
Okay, I think that's somewhat relevant as far as, mm-hmm. you know.
Mm-hmm. In other words, if we have a higher percent on Medicaid with a lower reimbursement rate, we are getting hammered harder.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So we'll find that out.
Since we have higher poverty. Yeah.
Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The E-Board's action that reduced or eliminated mental health coverage this summer, that did not... That was unrelated to the medically needy program. That was simply within...
That was for the Oregon Health Plan.
Just under the Oregon Health Plan.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And that kicks in when?
March 1st. And also on top of that, as part of our House Bill 5100 cuts, we will eliminate prescription drug coverage for that group as well. So we basically will have just the Medicaid-mandated services for that group, primarily hospital and physician care.
Okay, so mental illness on March 1st?
Outpatient treatment, and recognizing that also means as of March 1st, their meds are no longer covered either.
Okay. I've had some folks in my office who I think thought they were losing their mental health drugs through the medically needy program, but is that possible also?
Yes,
that people
it is possible.
Okay. I see.
We have
don't
12
they
pages
could go to OMIM if they had the money mm-hmm. to do that.
Okay.
We have 12 pages of DHS cuts beginning in January, so people are easily confused about which one is the one that's affecting
them. I'm one of those easily confused. So again, the outpatient care March 1st and prescription coverage.
Same time.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Looks like Gene turned the page.
Yeah, it's the last page. Really, what this tries to do is reinforce, again, the idea that I started out with, that the health plan is not the same as Medicaid. The health plan goes beyond Medicaid, and Medicaid goes beyond the health plan. And so what you'll see here is that when we look at OHP Medicaid, that basically, from the Medicaid components, includes the physical health, mental health, chemical dependency, and dental care components of Medicaid. Outside that, though, we also have the long-term care, our mental health institutions, residential chemical dependency care, home and community-based care, and the non-OHP Medicaid, such as the qualified Medicare beneficiaries. Someone asked me at an earlier meeting today kind of what's the split. I haven't had a chance to go back and find out, but my rough estimate would be on Medicaid, about half of it's in the health plan, about half of it's in these other ones on the left side. I think that's just comparing the OMAP budget with the former SDSD budget. But then, as you also know from some of the other discussions you've had, I believe you've had over the last week or so, there are pieces of the health plan that are outside Medicaid and that are outside DHS. So the Family Health Insurance Assistance Program, the Oregon Medical Insurance Pool, Insurance Pool Governing Board, and the Office for Oregon Health Policy and Research are all kind of pieces under the broad umbrella of being the Oregon Health Plan. I guess as kind of some concluding comments here, the health plan provides supports to people throughout DHS and actually beyond DHS. It's not a standalone program. It interrelates with many other parts. You could become eligible for the health plan because of coming in through another door. We've leveraged more and more and more over the years. As I said, I was pretty amazed when I saw these latest charts of how much of our general fund is Medicaid match now. We have kind of found what we can. I mean, there's always other ways we can maneuver and maybe get a little bit here and there, but we have leveraged so much that we really have very little general fund safety net left. And it's important, I think, as you continue in your deliberations to recognize the impact that, especially I think as we looked at the OHP standard population, that reduction of the options, interesting what services are optional in the minds of the federal government. But as we look at elimination as of March 1st of mental health, chemical dependency, prescription drugs for the standard population, those 100,000 or so, we will see ramifications in the health plan budget itself because those people still are entitled to hospital care and physician care. So if they can't get their meds and they show up at the hospital, we'll pay the bill. We may be paying it at less reimbursement than the hospital would care for, but we will be paying for that bill. So we would expect we'll have some increased utilization of the mandated services by elimination of those. Also, as people are not able to access their medications, especially maybe their mental health medications or chemical dependencies such as methadone, we may see ramifications in other parts of the DHS budget, but certainly in the public safety system. And as people, and you're already hearing, you've heard stories from sheriffs about the number of mentally ill inmates that they may have. And we are going to see ramifications in other parts of the state budget, in public and government budgets, whether it's state or local. So as you look at where do we go with the health plan, I would just ask you to keep in mind to recognize it's not just like another insurance program. It does provide services, and we need to look at those differently, that when those services go away, there are ramifications not only on the private sector through cost shift, but there may be ramifications in other parts of the state's budget. So I hope this has given you some sense of how, of the complexity of Medicaid. Actually, when I saw this, I said, when I started looking at, again, the percentage of our dollars that go to Medicaid, I realized it was probably not a bad idea to have a DHS director who knows, used to be a Medicaid director, and knows some of these issues. I'll be back. I'm scheduled to be back Thursday if you want to continue conversations then. Unless all of your questions have been answered.
I can assure you that with this group, their questions are not answered. I have a significant disagreement with one of your last statements, and that was you said that if you have impacts inside the Oregon Health Plan, it may have ramifications on other state services or costs.
Oh, it does have.
It has significant ramifications. You turn the wheel here, up through all the gears or down through all the gears, you're moving 14 revolutions over here. I mean, this thing is very interrelated, and I think perfect example, and this is, I think, going to be an issue for this committee and others in the building, is the impact of mental health in the justice system. So, the anyway, significant. You know that. Yes, we'd love to have you back.
Mr. Chair, one very important question, and it may have been answered earlier because I did arrive late, but did we fully answer the questions on this chart?
We did.
I don't know what my life's motto is or my stage name.
I'm sorry, I missed that part of the presentation.
I used to be Mean Jean, the Medicaid Queen, sure. But...
Fight over, spot, you know. One thing, if you could... on this chart, don't need it today or even Thursday, but could we get what the federal requirement is in terms of meeting the poverty level and then what we actually fund to and what the difference in caseload would be if we took it down to, I'm not proposing this or I want to do this, I just discussion purposes, if we... the difference in caseload if we took it down to the federal minimum.
Okay. And I think, Mr. Chair, I think where you'd see that primarily would be in poverty level medical and CHIP, because we are going beyond the federal mandates
right
there. And then OSIP, it's so screwy. It's almost hard. I mean, we could go from
don't
300.
Don't break your pick on
okay
it.
Okay.
She's got a pick.
A bit Mean Gene, you've heard it.
Oh, yeah.
Representative Anderson, did you have any questions?
I'll continue on Thursday.
Okay. Representative Murphy.
I'll mention the questions, and not for you to answer them now, but can come back on them. One, I get so many people emailing me saying, why did we choose the cuts we chose in 5100? Were we blackmailing the public? And I want to understand why we chose the things we did. And a lot of it sounds like it's federal. Mm-hmm. What's optional? But I'd like to get a better grip on that in order to be able to respond.
Talk about that on Thursday, or
if you could on Thursday.
Sure.
And second of all, I've heard that there may be.
Hold on. Let me be clear on what you're asking.
It's enumerated
for us to talk about on Thursday. What do you want to talk about on Thursday?
Yeah. I want to understand why in HB 5100, why we chose what we did to be cut, and so that I can explain it better to the people who are calling me.
In the context of Medicaid?
Yes. Yes.
I don't want to go there with this committee. I mean, we're trying to drive forward. I'll get with you.
Okay.
I've got the sheets. They've been provided by DHS. They did a very good
great
job in Representative Cruz's committee.
Oh, very good.
And so
okay. It's
not that.
Yeah, I think you did it.
I would just say the short answer is we went to where we had options.
That was my understanding.
We put flexibility on OHP, too, yeah. And we took out optional programs.
Okay. And it was also, I think it was explained in Senator Morissette's committee also, so okay. That there's been two presentations.
Right. Yeah.
Okay. Good. Not worth taking the time, then. Thank you. The other question is, I've heard rumors about patients committing suicide in anticipation of their benefits being cut, and I've also heard that those are urban myths, and if you have any information on that, I'd appreciate it.
Representative Anderson.
Two little quickies. I believe you said early on that the federal government was moving toward managed care, and what was the context for that statement? Was that something that you said, or was I dreaming?
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, maybe you were dreaming. We moved very aggressively towards managed care in Oregon, and I think, as you may have, I'm not sure if you talked some about managed care already, we've had, just even in the private sector, movement backwards. You know, we do think managed care, I mean, there is the outstanding issue of what's cheaper in the long term. I can say this for Medicaid clients, that our fee-for-service rates are so low, and that given also the competing pressures with Medicare reimbursement actually decreasing for physicians, that if someone is in fee-for-service, meaning they're not in a managed care plan, their ability to access services, especially physician services, is very limited. What managed care does is it guarantees them they'll be able to access services. And so I think, for instance, and I don't want to get into this too much now, but I think March 1st, as we lose those the mental health, chemical dependency, and prescription drug coverage for the standard clients, we likely will lose some, maybe all, or most, if not all, of the managed care capacity, and those people will be fee-for-service then. So we'll meet, because managed care plans don't want to take on the risk of hospital care when there's no prescription drugs to keep them out of the hospital. So we have, in Oregon, been moving for a long time. The federal government seems to be back and forth. I'm never too sure where they're headed on this.
And Representative Anderson, I appreciate that question because, you know, there's this perception that the Oregon Health Plan is out of control and that it's this, you know, incredibly unwieldy and inefficient delivery system, which includes a lot of managed care. And, you know, really, you look at it, we're not the best by any stretch of the imagination, but we do more with less than most. I mean, we have one of the lower cost delivery systems. And it goes back to the federal Medicaid reimbursement, federal Medicare, the system that's derived up around that disadvantaged reimbursement rate is, I think, correct me if I'm wrong, one of the reasons we've structured our system the way it has. Now, having said that, I mean, you know, has it this particular delivery system, delivery model, gone as far as, you know, we can drive the car? I mean, is this one out of gas? Is it about ready to implode based on available resources? Mm-hmm. That's really the question before this committee.
One other quick question, that is, I was told by a local IPA over the weekend that they have a number of patients that were accessing care both in the Oregon Health Plan and in the Veterans Administration, and there were a lot of duplication. If they didn't hear what they wanted at the local IPA doctor, they'd go to the Veterans Hospital and crisscross, and it was costing a lot more than it should. I don't know how wide.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, Representative Anderson, maybe Lynn can talk to you specifically, or have someone talk to you specifically about that, because I know that's a question down in your area. And I
guess my question would be, can it be limited anyway, or do other states limit to a veterans or a Medicaid, but not both?
It's a complicated question. I remember trying to find the answer to. There's certain, and I think it also has to do with what specific benefits VA may cover versus what they're entitled to under Medicaid. Okay. But perhaps Lynn can get the answer to that and then talk to you about that.
Representative Bates.
I'm not going to give you all these questions. I've got seven or eight questions I'll give you after the meeting and ask to report back on. But the key question for me is one you probably cannot answer right now, but I'd like to have you put through your mind. The Medicaid program or health plan program's basic problem in this state is no different than it is in other states in many ways.
It's
no different than it is in many other states. We have a system which, frankly, is probably more efficient than most other states because this state has a high number of managed care plans. Mm-hmm. That are commercial plans that we've piggybacked on. Mm-hmm. Although the question of fee-for-service versus managed care is hopefully going to be answered by comparing Jackson and Josephine counties. Mm-hmm. I'll tell you why later. Mm-hmm. Okay? And hope we can have some information on that even by tomorrow, if possible. Okay?
Longitudinal study between today and tomorrow. Okay.
But the real...
I told you to say 6:15 tonight.
Yeah.
It's going to be there. It may not be accurate, but it's going to be there. But the real question we're trying to answer is there any system that will work for this population and keep the entire healthcare system from imploding? Because nationally, that's what we're looking at. And I don't expect an answer tonight or tomorrow. That's something we need
but
to keep in,
Thursday,
the back of, but keep in the back of our minds, because that's where we're working to here. That's what this committee, I think, is really working to, mm-hmm. is how can we reform this in a way that still functions.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, at the end of the day, based on federal constraints, reimbursement rates, we're going to try to stick as many fingers in the holes in the dike as we can. And this is a federal solution mm-hmm. that we have to shore up our current delivery system until we wait for it.
That's right.
That's where we are. Before everyone runs off, I want what we're going to do tomorrow is kind of what we've been doing sans, you know, expert testimony or witness, is I just want to kick around in the formal committee structure, ideas we've heard, thoughts, concerns, questions. If you've got some additional questions for Gene or OMAP or Lynn, get those to Rick and sooner than Thursday, because then they'll have time to be able to answer them. But tomorrow, I think, is a very important day just in terms of us interfacing, coming up with questions, concerns, sharing thoughts, ideas, coming up with additional questions, theories, whatever. So let's try to get here promptly at 3. And Katie, I just want you to know there is no real truth to the rumor that we are going to defund the public health department completely.
She is here for all of health services.
97%, 98%, 99%, yes, but not completely.
Representative, which of these should we bring back on Thursday?
Both.
All?
Bring them all. And bring your books. And Jeff, what I'm going to get you has 5,100 cuts,
the
e-board cuts.
the ones Rocky handed out.